Where in Isaiah are we? That's different than where in the world is Carmen Sandiego.
30.
No, we didn't get to the, we will get into 30. We're in 29, about verse.
Doing what?
Didn't get that far. 29, verse 9. Yeah. But we will. And by the way, we're not going to finish chapter 30 today. So what does that mean?
Reading.
Well, you always have six chapters to read, always. But except the last time when we only gave you five chapters to read because 24 was the beginning of a major section. So we've been reading 24 through 30 this time, and you're going to do it one more week. And then next week, the reading assignment will be 31 through 36. But so remember your reading assignment. I know that it's valuable. I know it's valuable because this is such a massive book, and there's so much information, and it's so interconnected that by going back and rereading what we've studied and pre-reading what we're going to study, the information will stick better. So that's my little pep talk to keep up the good work. All this, keep up the good work. But I want to go back and just a couple things I wanted to pick up, try to connect up and keep going. What is the what do I want to say? The overwhelming political pressure that evoked this book. The invasion of Assyria. Absolutely. The invasion of Assyria. That's what the people were facing. That's what they were concerned about. That's why they were wondering, did God care about them? Is there any reward for staying faithful to him? Should we go down to Egypt and hire help? Should we just, what should we do? And so it really massive. Try to imagine what it's like being an Iranian right now. Their whole world would be unsettled, in a turmoil, and they don't know whether they're going to land on their feet or not. And that would be the way Israel was at this point in time. And some of the phrases that have been used are darkness. The invasion of Assyria plunged the nation of Israel into darkness. The overwhelming scourge when it passes through. Remember, we talked about that. This was a massive political, geopolitical upheaval. And so how we deal with that, and why was God allowing it to happen to Israel? Remember back in chapter 24, 24, 5, 6, and 7 is typically known as the little apocalypse or Isaiah's apocalypse. It's very, very much like the entire book of Revelation, only condensed into four chapters instead of 22. It's like a preview of Matthew 24, only bigger, but less urgent, perhaps. But what did they say in Isaiah 24? What is it, about verse 5? Why was there a scorched earth approach to his people? Why did God allow the serious burning?
Transgressed laws, violated statutes, and broke his everlasting
Broke
covenant.
the everlasting covenant. They were lawbreakers. They were lawbreakers. And but especially they violated the everlasting covenant. They broke the Ten Commandment covenant that they made with God on Mount Sinai, which came with Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28, it came with a series of curses, didn't it? And so that's what Isaiah 24 was about, the curse that was being poured out on the land because of their violation of the covenant. That's why the Assyrian was allowed to invade. That's why the people were told, those who were faithful, duck and cover. wait a little while. Where was that? Did you just, think it was toward the end of 20. It just flashed in my mind, and I didn't look it up. It might be the end of 27, but those who are waiting on Yahweh, you just have to hide yourself for a little while. Remember him saying that? Hide yourself for a little while, and till the scourge passes. Obviously, I'm not going to find it, but if you look for that phrase, hide yourself for a little while, you'll find it. That this was coming, and the faithful, all they could do was weather the storm. Reminds me, Scott, it reminds me of what Habakkuk concluded. I know it's coming, and it causes me to tremble, causes me to shudder, but I trust the faithfulness of God, and I'll weather the storm and see what comes out on the other side. Isaiah is a little earlier than Habakkuk, but he's talking about the same thing. Now, we start, we. Michael?
I think it's chapter 26, verse 20.
What does that say?
Oh, I'm not on it right now. I just, sorry.
All right. 26:20. Come, my people, enter into your room and close your door behind you. Hide for a little while until the indignation runs its course. That idea of the indignation is a key theme in the book of Daniel, which was a couple generations later than Isaiah. And he talked about how that led right up to the destruction of Jerusalem by Rome. The indignation of God against his people had to run its course. So this darkness that came at the end of chapter 8, or the mention of the darkness, came with the Assyrian invasion, chapter 8. But in chapter 9, the people sitting in darkness saw a great light. And so the end of the darkness came when they saw the great light. And yet that's quoted in Matthew 4 of the ministry of Jesus. So this darkness, whether it was a rather lengthy period of time, and the faithful would have to trust God. You remember, Alan, what Ahaz was told in chapter 7? If you do not believe, you will not stand. Okay, so God is allowing these nations to come in and whoop up on Israel. Remember chapter 10, Assyria was seen as an axe in the hand of God to cut down the forest. And yet in chapter 11, there would be a sprout that would come up from the root of Jesse. So God's forest wasn't completely cut down. Jesus would come out of it still. So a lot of imagery. But here in chapter 29, where we ended last week, verses 1 through 8, but 1 through 4, Ariel. Do you remember the two meanings of Ariel? Woe, O Ariel, Ariel, the city where David once camped. Well, what is Ariel? And it's not a font type. That's spelled with an A, not an E. Ariel. El is God. Okay? Ariel. Remember what it meant?
The lioness of
Had
Judah.
two meanings. Lion of God and altar of God. And so you look down here in verse 2, she will be like an Ariel to me. I'll bring destruction. She's going to be the altar upon which I make this great sacrifice. Okay. And you'll be brought low, and you'll hear the voice will be like that of a spirit from the ground. And we connected that verse 4, we connected that with chapter 26, 14 through 19, where all we could do was whisper, and we couldn't bring a rescue or a repopulation. And so we were dead in the water. And God said in verse 19, your dead will live. Hey, Chris, come on in and join the crowd. Well, thank you for being here. And so your voice will be like a spirit from the ground. And so if you go back, like I said, to chapter 26, you'll see that the total devastation, the total sense of helplessness. The foreign gods can't bring us back to life. We can't do anything to repopulate. And God says, your dead will live. You will come back to life. But here we're talking about in 29, 1 through 4, we're in Isaiah 29, Chris. In Isaiah 29, 1 through 4, he's talking about how God would offer up his people as a sacrifice when he destroyed the city. But now, if I'm going to do that to you, what am I going to do to your enemies? See, the multitude of your enemies, they'll become like dust. Now, what happens to dust when there's a windstorm? Who was it that's saying all we are is dust in the wind?
Endless.
There's a lot of dust flying through Kansas at times. Okay. That's what your enemies will be like. It'll be like the ruth of the multitude of the ruthless ones, be like the chaff which blows away. Now, pause and think with me. Pause and think with me. Who were the enemies of God's people? Was it just the Assyrians? How about the leaders, the corrupt leaders that were distorting things and bringing the judgment upon the people? In the days of Jesus, the every bad thing that happened to Christians happened at the instigation of Jews. As you read through the book of Acts, it was always at the instigation of the Jews. So the multitude of the ruthless one, like chaff which blows away, you remember Matthew 3, verse 12, his winnowing fork is in his hand. He will thoroughly clean his threshing floor. He'll gather the grain into the barn, and the chaff will blow away or be burned up with a fire that can't be quenched. What was the chaff in that illustration? Everybody who did not follow Jesus. Everybody. The ones who followed Jesus was the grain that God kept. The rest of the Jewish nation that didn't follow Jesus were the chaff that was burned up. So here, this verse, chapter 29, verse 5, the multitude of the ruthless ones would include, you see, would include the godless among the nation of Jesus, the generation of Jesus. And Yahweh of hosts will be, from Yahweh of hosts, you will be punished with thunder and earthquake and loud noise, wind, whirlwind and tempest, and the flame of a consuming fire. Have you ever heard, maybe you have, somewhere in the New Testament that says our God is a consuming fire? Where'd you hear it? Okay.
Peter.
I want the address. I want to go knock on that door. Yeah, it's in Hebrews. In Hebrews 10 at verse 22. That's not the passage we're looking for yet. But Hebrews 10, 22 says, well, I had it and I dropped it. Hebrews 10, 22. Let us draw, no, that's not the one I wanted. I wrote down the wrong verse. 27. If we go on, 26, if we go on sinning willfully after receiving the knowledge of the truth. Now get this one straight. That's not, I'm going to go out here and sin, and it's just, it's rejecting Jesus. That's the willful sin of the book of Hebrews, rejecting Jesus. I'm going, but the sacrifice of Jesus was insufficient. I'm waiting for a better one. Okay? If we go on sinning willfully after receiving a knowledge of it, there no longer remains a sacrifice. There's no more sacrifice coming. But what is coming, a certain terrifying expectation of judgment and the fury of a fire which will consume the adversary. That sounds a whole lot like this passage here in Isaiah 29. But look over here in chapter 12, verse 29, where he says, I'm going to start in 28. Therefore, since we receive a kingdom which cannot be shaken, whole lot of shaking going on. There's some scorched earth going on until the light shone. But there are people who trusted God who were hiding themselves and waiting for the deliverance from God. Okay? And what happens when they started shaking things? What happens when you start shaking a tree with fruit on it?
The bad ones
The
fall.
fruit falls off. An earthquake might shake a building down. Expand that idea. A nation that is not fit to last could be shaken by God. But we receive a kingdom that cannot be shaken. Since we receive a kingdom that cannot be shaken, Let us show gratitude by which we may offer to God an acceptable service with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. I'm saying that the Hebrews writer wasn't just picking a really nice thought out of the book of Isaiah. He's connecting what was about to happen in the days of the people of Hebrews to what Isaiah was talking about. The soon in the Hebrews, what did he say in chapter 10? In a very, very little while, he was coming, will come. The coming of the Lord to destroy Jerusalem was in a very, very little while after the book of Hebrews was written. Our God is a consuming fire. These things in Isaiah were fulfilled, say, in the tearing down of Jerusalem in the generation of Jesus. All right. But watch verse 7. The multitude of all the nations who wage war against Israel. Now, they're doing God's job, right? Of sacrificing the godless, the worthless, the not the worthless, that's a bad word, but the ruthless, the godless and the ruthless. They're sacrificing them on his behalf, but they're waging war against God's people. And he says, the multitude, verse 7, the multitude of all the nations who wage war against Israel, even all who wage war against her and her stronghold and who distress her, shall be like a dream, a vision of the night. Remember, we talked about that. You dream, you're a hungry man, and you dream you ate a just a really nice ham sandwich. But you wake up, and all you see is you've been chewing on your pillow, and you're still hungry. He says, that's what it's going to be like for these nations. They just, it'll be like a dream that is gone. And you wonder, where is it? Verse, end of verse 8. Thus the multitude of all the nations shall be who wage war against Mount Zion. Now, in chapter, hello, Angelina. In chapter 2, verses 1 through 4, when God raised up the mountain of the house of Yahweh as the chief of the mountains, and all the nations would stream to it, what would they do with their swords and their spears? Make them into farming implements,
Train them into
because there
plowshares.
would no longer be the need to defend themselves against the invasion like they felt with Assyria. Because all who wage war against Mount Zion, God will take care of them. We saw that also back in chapter 27. I don't have any wrath. Somebody tries to invade my vineyard, I'll just step on it. Or let him make peace with me. That's 27 verse 5. Okay. Now, let's pick up, that's all review, by the way. That's all connective review. I have a book by a man named Gregory. It's called The Seven Laws of Teaching. Amazing book on how to teach effectively. But someone came along and parodied it and said, you know what the seven laws of teaching are? Review, 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 and review. Going over and over and over is what anchors it. And Peter said the same thing in 2 Peter. I'm going to stir your minds up by way of reminder. Okay, so review. I'm not apologizing. I'm explaining why I spend so much time in review. New material. Be delayed and wait. Blind yourself and be blind. Who are you talking to? They become drunk, but not with wine. They stagger, but not with strong drink. Who's he talking to?
Probably the leaders.
Yeah, that'd be my guess. Talking here to the leaders. And they stagger, but not with strong drink. What's he talking about? They're blind, they're drunk, but not with wine. What are they drunk with? Why are they staggering? Not strong drink. Power? Ego? Great answers. Great answers. We know how to do this.
Authority.
Authority. All of that. See? Position and power and ego and undergirding and under as a foundation of all of that is a lack of respect for their maker. Okay? They stagger. For Yahweh has poured over you a spirit of deep sleep. He has shut your eyes, the prophets. He has covered your heads, the seers. What do you suppose he means by that? Yahweh has shut your eyes, the prophets, and covered your heads, the seers. You suppose he's talking about legitimate prophets of Yahweh? Or is he talking about the prophets that they're listening to?
Reminds me of the prophets in Jeremiah.
It's only 100 years later.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. People like to hear what they like to hear. And they're will and we're going to see this in a minute, Alan. And they're willing to pay people to say what they want them to say. Okay? He says, I make them drunk. I make them blind. I cover them up. Anything they say is going to be worthless. And the entire vision shall be to you like words of a sealed book. Now, I think the entire vision is this entire message of Isaiah. Now, you remember what we saw last week, the scoffers, what they said about Isaiah's message? Who's he going to teach? Yeah, I hear a word, there a word, a little here, a little there. Line upon line, line upon line, precept on precept. Like, this guy, who's he think he's dealing with? Just this pedantic way of, why would Isaiah have to frame his message like a grade school teacher would? Because they're not mature in God. It reminds me of what Paul said in 1 Corinthians 3. I couldn't speak to you as men, but as babes, almost as men of flesh, because they hadn't grown. Okay, and so remember the scoffers. They're looking at Isaiah's message. Are just, man, this is so trivial, so pathetic, so far beneath us. So the entire vision will be to you like the words of a sealed book. You know what happens when you close your mind? Nothing penetrates. Okay? And when they give it to one who is literate, saying, please read this, he says, I can't. It's sealed. Then it will be given to the one who is illiterate, saying, please read this. Yeah, I can't read. Nobody's understanding the message that Isaiah is laying down to them. Then Yahweh said, because this people draw near me with their words and honor me with their lip service, but remove their hearts far from me, and their reverence for me consists of tradition, of learned tradition. Therefore, behold, I will once again deal marvelously, wondrously marvelous with this people. See, since they are superficial, Chris, I don't think it's they can't understand the message. I think that they have closed their mind so they don't understand the message. Oh, there might be a few who are illiterate and can't, but the majority were closing their minds and wouldn't. Or you might say it this way, Alan. The religious leaders who should be literate said, well, the book is sealed. We choose not to understand it. And those who are being fed by them who are spiritually illiterate, so we can't read. Either way, the message of Isaiah was lost on the people. They didn't get it. Then Yahweh said, because they draw near with their words. Say, they are pretending that they are God-fearing people, but they don't want to know what I have to say to them. They've rejected it. We've already seen that. Therefore, I'm going to deal marvelously, wondrously with this people. What do you suppose he's talking about there? Go back to chapter 24, 1 through 6, the scorched earth. He's not lost that. This people is being invaded as Isaiah was speaking, by the Assyrian army, which would be followed by the Babylonian army, which would be followed by the Medo-Persian army, which would be followed by the Grecian army, which would be followed by the Roman army, wave after wave after wave of influx of oppression because God's people had violated the everlasting covenant. And he says, I'm going to deal wondrously marvel. What has he done so far to this people? Hadn't torn their temple down yet, has he? At the reading of Isaiah, 100 years before he tears the temple down, the first time. But he's not talking about that either. He's talking about when he brings the whole shebang to an end. It's why it's called the last days, when he brings the whole shebang to an end. When Rome invaded Jerusalem. Now, what's this? And the wisdom of their wise shall perish, and the discernment of their discerning shall be concealed. Now, I think last week, didn't we connect the scoffers back, the ones that said, yeah, he doesn't know what he's talking about line upon line? Who were the scoffers that said that? Verse 14, the leaders. Those who were the rulers were the scoffers. Did we not connect that to 2 Peter 3? In the last days, scoffers will come with their scoffing. Say, where's the sign of his coming? Here Isaiah is saying he's going to come and tear that temple down because of the violation of the covenant. And the religious leaders in the days of Peter are saying, yeah, right. Yeah, that's going to happen. He says, verse 14, and the wisdom of their wise men shall perish. Does that sound familiar, Scott? The wisdom of their wise shall perish, the discernment of their discerning men shall be concealed. Now, what he's saying is their wise leadership hasn't a clue where they're going. We saw that in the picture of the staggering, didn't we? Now we're seeing it as the concealing of wisdom. Man, these guys don't know what they're talking about. Now, I'm not going to get political here, but there are some decisions that our president has made that have opened up the ridicule by various lawmakers. Just talking points, yak, 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 yak. And they're all over the board. Some say this, some say that. And nobody knows really what they're talking about. And I don't know what any of them are talking about. But here's the thing I do know, that most of them have no idea how God would guide people. And so we need to do this or we need to do that. Their leaders, the wisdom of their wise men, they don't know how to get out of this mess. Some want to go down to Egypt, as we'll see in the next chapter, we'll hire the Egyptians to help us in the overwhelming scourge will pass us by because we've made a covenant with death. We've already seen that point last week. Some want to fight. Some want to trust Yahweh. When Jerusalem was invaded by the Romans, there were at least three parties in Rome. There was the
In Jerusalem.
in Jerusalem. I'm sorry. Yes, in Jerusalem. Some wanted to trust Yahweh. Some wanted to surrender to the Romans. Some wanted to fight them off. And what they ended up doing is plundering each other's stores and anyway, that's a study for the book of Revelation. But the wisdom was gone. So nobody knew how to make a good decision. But I asked you, does it sound familiar? I'm hoping you're thinking 1 Corinthians chapter 1, where Paul says in verse 18, for the word of the cross is to those who are perishing foolishness. But to us who are being saved, it is God's power. For it is written. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and the cleverness of the clever, I will set aside. Isaiah 29:14. Paul quotes this as what happened when they crucified Jesus. Look at chapter 2, verse 6. It says, yet we speak wisdom among those who are mature. However, not of this age, nor of the rulers of this age who are passing away. That's what we're talking about here in Isaiah 29. But we speak God's wisdom in a mystery, the hidden, which God predestined before the ages to our glory, which none of the rulers, you might insert the word scoffers from Isaiah 28, 29, 27, 20, 29. None of the scoffers of this age has understood. For if they'd understood it, they wouldn't have crucified the Lord of glory. They knew what God was doing. They wouldn't have crucified Jesus. Because by crucifying Jesus, Satan was whooped. Satan thought he was winning when he crucified Jesus, but he killed himself instead. And so this passage is quoted, you see, in the New Testament of the things that were going on at that time. Then he says in verse 15, woe to those who deeply hide their plans from Yahweh and whose deeds are in a dark place, who say, oops, or who knows? Nobody knows what we're doing here. You know what it makes me think of? Those legendary smoke-filled rooms where the elite gather secretly to make plans. Nobody knows what we're doing. All this is clandestine, as though God doesn't know. See, that's the problem. I don't know what happens in the cabinet meetings that President Trump has. I don't know what happens out at Camp David, if they ever go there anymore. I don't know if they do. I don't know what happens in those summit conferences where the leaders of the world meet and discuss. I don't know what happens, but God does. And they might think that since nobody knows, we can get away with it. Or who said to him who formed it, he has no understanding. That what this thing that God is doing, he doesn't know what he's doing. We better fix it. Does that ring true? God doesn't know what he's doing in the world today, so we better fix it. We're not the first generation who thought that maybe God lost control of what's going on, so we got to fix it, right? And this is God chiding the scoffers, the fools, the leaders. And he says, they're thinking everything's going down the rat hole. We better hire Egypt to help us. Now, go back to chapter 7. What happened when they hired Assyria to help them? They brought the scourge in. They invited the scourge in. So, we better invite Egypt to help us. I mean, they didn't even learn from their own mistakes. Okay. But they also didn't know what God was doing. So, what does he know? What is he doing? He doesn't have a clue what's going on with us. Do you suppose God has a clue what's going on with us, U.S.? He has absolute understanding and complete guidance of where he's taking the world. How he gets it there is up to him. And I may challenge him and say, boy, that doesn't make sense to me. But that's what they're doing here. Say, what does he know? I'm not going to do that. See, here's his response. Is it not yet just a little while before Lebanon will be turned into a fertile field and a fertile field will be considered a forest? And on that day, the deaf shall hear words of a book. Boy, doesn't that take you right back up to verse 11? My vision is a sealed book nobody can understand, but there's a day coming when even the deaf will understand what I'm saying to them. And the blind will see. The afflicted shall increase their gladness in Yahweh, and the needy of mankind shall rejoice in the Holy One of Israel. There's a day coming. Has there been a day coming in the book of Isaiah yet? Like in that day, what about a son will be given? The mountain of the house of the Lord be raised up as the chief of the mountains? All kinds of things projected for the future hope of Israel. All these things were to give the people of Israel that were facing the Assyrian onslaught the kind of hope to stay true to God during the onslaught. Okay? Alan, it's easy to stay true to God when everything's going great. But if God is worth staying true to, you'll stay true to him even when it's rough, even when you can't see the way out, because you know that he knows, right? And that's kind of the underwriting theme here of Isaiah. God knows what's going to happen to this people. He's telling them it's going to be good. He's saying you're going to have to go through rough times. Trust me. If you will not believe, you will not stand or last, whichever one it says. Okay? So, verse 19, the afflicted shall also increase their gladness. Who was afflicting whom? Who are the afflicted? Who are the needy? But the ruth because the ruthless will come to an end, and the scorner, read scoffer, will be finished. Indeed, all who are intent on doing evil will be cut off, who cause a person to be indicted by a word, and ensnare him who adjudicates it at the gate, and defraud the one in the right with meaningless arguments. You know what is said in the U.S.? If you have enough money, you can hire enough lawyers to get you out of almost anything. Twist and convolute and distort the argument and get people, I can't follow, he must be innocent. Okay. Who defraud the one in the right with meaningless arguments. Now, this takes us back, say, to chapter 5, the picture of the vineyard and the woes, the rotten grapes that God found included. Let me go back and look at this one with you, chapter 5, Isaiah 5, and I'm going to start about verse 19. A series of woes here. Verse 18, woe to those who drag iniquity with the cords of falsehood, and sin as if with cart ropes, who say, let him make speed, let him hasten his work, that we might say, in other words, God's not going to do anything about us. And let the purpose of the Holy One of Israel draw near and come to pass, that we may know. Woe to those who call evil good. Woe and good evil. Woe who substitute darkness for light and light for darkness. They do that by their argumentation. They do that by their intricate words and their cunning speech. How does it read there back in chapter 29? Defraud the one in the right with meaningless arguments. Back here in chapter 5 again, verse 21, woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. Woe to those who are heroes and drinking wine and valiant men and strong mixing strong drink, who justify the wicked for bribe. He's talking specifically about the judges here who have such lofty position and take away the rights of the ones who are in the right. The moral and the social and the economic and the judicial decay of a society is a concern to God. And that's what he's addressing here. And I'm going to turn things around. I'm going to bring a blossomy vineyard, orchard, pasture land, and forest, and but I'm going to put an end to those who are destroying all that. For thus says, verse 22, thus says Yahweh, who redeemed Abraham concerning the house of Jacob, Jacob shall not now be ashamed, nor shall his face turn pale. At the time that Isaiah was writing this, what was the status and the stature of of Jacob in the eyes of the world? They're being invaded, weren't they? They were seen like ripe fruit ready to be picked. And God was letting it happen because they were ripe fruit that needed to be picked, rotten fruit that needed to be removed.
Rod,
Yeah.
Jacob here is synonymous with Ephraim, then, as a northern kingdom, a terminology used for the northern kingdom.
I no, 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 no. Joseph would be. Jacob was all 12. Jacob was also Israel, recall?
Yeah.
So Israel will not now be ashamed. When God reverses the fortunes of the remnant, they'll no longer be embarrassed. They'll no longer look at themselves as ashamed to be the offspring of Jacob. And Jacob himself would not be looking at this, the people, not the remnant, but the people, the nation as a whole. He wouldn't be looking at his offspring and saying, boy, I wish they weren't that bad. Say, Jacob would be ashamed of what he saw in his people. But when God reverses their fortunes, he won't be ashamed. So, wow, that's what God did. Look what God did. Look what he brought out of all this suffering. A people who are dedicated to him in their hearts, committed to him, and will even lay their lives down instead of surrendering the truth. Okay? So I think that's what it's talking about there, Michael.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Jacob represented like the southern tribes.
No. Jacob represents all 12.
But it's a struggle, right?
Yeah,
So maybe
but it's
there's
no,
differences.
don't leave maybe out of there. Jacob is Israel. Jacob and Israel are synonymous. And so, no, hire a nobler name. Yeah, the mighty one of God. But don't use that to say I'm talking about two different groups of people. He's talking about the same group of people, the offspring of Jacob. Jacob would look at what God did with his offspring and say, I'm not ashamed of them. I'm not ashamed that they're my children anymore. He would be ashamed of what he saw at the time of Isaiah. But when God got finished, he wouldn't be ashamed anymore. But when he sees his children, the work of my hands in his midst, they will sanctify my name. Indeed, they will sanctify the Holy One of Jacob. The Holy One of Jacob. Now, this idea of children is thematic through the book of Isaiah. We'll not pursue it, but you can if you want to look at where back in the end chapters 60 through 66, where did all these children come from? Chapter 54, remember chapter 53? Remember, we haven't got there yet, but you know this one well. Where the suffering servant, the song of the suffering servant, he's cut off, and if he'd render himself a guilt offering, he'd see an offspring. Who has believed our report? You know that. But it ends with him being sacrificed, but coming back to life and seeing his offspring. And then chapter 54, it says, the children of the barren woman were more than the children of the woman who had a husband. The barren woman was this faithful remnant that wasn't producing. The woman who had a husband, well, the Ten Commandment covenant was a covenant of marriage between God and Israel. And she had a husband, but look at the children she produced. Galatians 4, the Jerusalem from above is our mother. And the allegory of Sarah and Hagar. Hagar, who had children the natural way, Sarah says, send away the children of the bond servant. They shall not inherit with my son. And Paul says that's an analogy of those who follow Jesus and are born of the Jerusalem above, the children of Jacob, as compared to those who are born naturally, the physical offspring of Abraham. They got circumcision and the Sabbath and all that, and they must be right with God. No, they're cut off because they won't follow Jesus. And so the offspring that came through the faithful woman, Revelation 12, the faithful remnant who gave birth to the Son, who was taken up to heaven. And then the earth was filled with the offspring of that faithful woman. That's what he's talking about here. That's what he's talking about right here. They will see, Jacob will see all these children, where they come from. And we'll see that as we go on through the book. Verse 24, and those who err in mind will know the truth, and those who criticize will accept instruction. When God does his reversal, it's going to be, now what happens when you are wrong and you learn and know and accept instruction? What's that called? Pardon?
Wisdom.
It is wisdom. It's also called
repent.
that's it, because you're changing your mind. See, they err in truth, but they'll know the truth. They criticize, but they'll accept correction. And so I love that, because not everybody who crucified Jesus was converted to Jesus on the day of Pentecost. God gave them 40 years to change their minds before he brought the destruction against Jerusalem. Now, we've got about 10 minutes left, and I don't want to go. I said we're going to go down through verse 5. I think I said verse 9, but I meant 5 because 9 is halfway through the paragraph. So, but this is approaching the impending threat. It's not even impending. It's just kind of like it is oppressive. It's already there. It's already invaded their hearts and minds because the invasion is impending. And one of the ways that they decided that they would deal with it is this: woe to the rebellious children, declares Yahweh, who execute a plan, but not mine, and make an alliance, but not of my spirit. What's he saying? They're making their own decisions. This is the staggering that we're talking about, staggering through the drunkenness of their own wisdom, their own decisions, their own things. So this is how it works best. What are they doing? In order to add sin to sin, who proceed down to Egypt without consulting me. Now, this is just an interesting commentary on that reading. But you think about the life of David, and there were times when he had some really bad consequences come upon him. And every time that there was a horrendous consequence was a time when he acted without asking God. Now, I know that's the case because there's times when he shouldn't have had any kind of victory, but he did because he inquired of God. What should I do? Do this. Will they deliver me? Yeah, they will. Then what should I do? Go hide in the forest. Every time that he asked God, he got the wisdom he needed to escape. Those times he didn't ask God, he got himself in a big heap of trouble. That wasn't just David. See, here are some people who lived after David. Says they're making plans without consulting me to take refuge in the safety of Pharaoh. Yeah, that's going to work. Pharaoh is far more capable of delivering my people than I am. Isn't that the thought that had to go behind that? Mm-hmm. Let's not trust God. I mean, what's God going to do? Here we are. We're just sitting ducks. Quack. And they're coming with their shotguns. Quack. Well, we better come down here and see if we can find this guy that's got the blind. And maybe he'll protect us. Or, you know, my God is a wall of fire about me. There were prophets preceding this. Elijah, encircled by the Syrian army in a little village called Dothan. And his servant was just panicking. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? And Elijah prayed, Lord, open his eyes that he can see. And when his eyes were open, he saw chariots of fire surrounding the army. God was always there. He just didn't see it. Now, what I'm saying is, here's a generation, several generations later, that was part of their history and culture, and they didn't trust God. Maybe the king of Egypt will be better at protecting us than God can. Fools. Yeah.
We could pray that our president could see that God offers some help so we don't have to.
I suspect there's a lot of people praying for Mr. Trump and all the leaders. Mm-hmm. If not, we're dropping the ball. Okay. To take refuge in the safety of Pharaoh and seek shelter in the shadow of Egypt. Therefore, the safety of Pharaoh will be your shame. What do you suppose he means by that? And the shelter in the shadow, your humiliation. What do you suppose he means by that?
They went to the wrong
Yeah.
See
Not the right
Your
choice.
plan backfired. Yeah.
Now,
Not only will it not work, but you will have turned your back on what does work, and it'll be too late. So Egypt's going to just be your downfall, your humiliation. For their princes are at Zoan, and their ambassadors arrive at Hanes. Those two places. Cities in southern Egypt, Zoan is sometimes connected to the palatial palace. That's kind of a double gemuffle, isn't it? The palace of the Pharaoh who banned kicked Moses out of Egypt, or chased Moses out of Egypt. Okay, but what he's saying is the princes and ambassadors of Israel are already at the palaces of the leaders of Egypt. They're already there. They, everyone will be ashamed because of a people who cannot profit them, not for help or profit, but for shame and also for reproach. Your trust in somebody other than me is going to lead you embarrassed. And what does it mean, reproach? Shame is something you feel. What's reproach?
Was given in my heart.
Say again.
Others give a hard time. They look
It's
yeah.
Yeah, it's
how others look at you. How others look at you. Yeah. And sometimes even using your name as a curse. May you be like Egypt. Or may you be like Israel, say, as a byword. And because you didn't trust me, you decided you're going to hire Egypt. Now, the next piece of the reading is about the caravans that are taking the blessings of God that were bestowed upon Israel and shopping in Egypt for help. It's just we'll see that next week. Any thoughts? Any comments or discussions.
Right.
Michael?
Yeah, some of this is portrayed over in Chronicles or Kings, right? In the same time factor.
Well, when we get to what are the chapters 36 through 39, I think. We're basically going to be just having the historical account. Yeah, beginning of verse 36, chapter 36, all the way 39, all the way through 39 is like it's lifted out of the book of Chronicles or the book of Kings, and just because it is a historical background for all of this.
Okay.
Yep. So if you want to know what's going on in the time of Isaiah, go to Chronicles and Kings. And you'll see the history right there. But you can also extract it from the reading, can't you? We know what they were like judicially. We know what they were like culturally, economically. We know what they were like morally because of what we read here in Isaiah. Now that's a really a severe warning. Because you look at the United States, and it's not a whole lot different when you come to the moral, and the cultural, especially human sexuality is just disgusting. What is rampant in our culture that even when I was Alan's age was not as rampant. When I was Maddie's age. There's these things were not happening out in the open like they are now. And so, I mean, we look at this and we say, yeah, God's really going to get them. And the idiot leaders didn't know how to guide these people into a safe place. You're like having a blindfold on a ship's captain in a storm. They didn't know what, how to steer the thing. And I get the feeling that we're in that same condition. You look at our elected officials and the the philosophic mindset that they take to legislating our laws. And it's a couple things are obvious. Number one, obvious is they do not know the mind of God. And number two, they are so discombobulated and disunified that it's like people grabbing at the steering wheel of a car. I want to go there. I want to go there. I want to go. They don't have a clue. And anyway, I don't want to be a Debbie Downer on the United States because Hebrews 12, I am part of a kingdom which cannot be shaken even when the nation I'm in is shaken to nothing. I'm still part of a kingdom that can't be shaken. Okay. Thoughts? Alrighty.
To be a National Day of Prayer, and then the president is also going to
Yeah.
declare this.
You know, those are interesting things. But if people are not on their knees, whether there's a National Day of Prayer or not, it one day is not going to make a difference. And we should not put our confidence in big events. We should put our confidence in the everyday repetitive godliness of the culture.